dissident discourse. It can only be millennial. And now here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello and welcome back to Millennial X. I'm now here with Walt Bismarck. Now that's a name that some of you will remember. Some of you will be familiar with his new work, but also some of you will remember him from quite a long time ago, the sort of peak of the alt-right in 2015-16. Walt, this is your first time on Millennial, despite that heritage. So welcome to the show, and could you introduce yourself to the audience?
Thank you. But I will correct you on that, because I actually appeared on the very first one. Well, it was only for like a few minutes, but and I'll share a little funny anecdote. That's actually where I met my first girlfriend. She and I were on the same segment. We were, because you had on two guys. One was advocating, I think, third positionism, and the other one was advocating like libertarianism, and they were sort of like clashing with one another. I very distinctly remember like that was a time when I sort of was kind of going between like anarcho-capitalism, like the sort of like Hobbesian impulse, and then I guess more of a sort of third positionist impulse. So I was very like invested in that debate. So I do remember I was on for like 5 seconds. But yes, this is the first, appearance in earnest that I have. So yeah, thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it. So do you want me to just kind of give like a rundown of what I did back in the day, or
yes.
What I was sort of notable? Yeah, okay. So I was, a satirist is the best way to describe me. I was, I like to also describe myself as a metapolitical theorist as well. But I mean, to the extent that I did that, it was kind of like indirectly through my videos. I kind of saw myself as somebody who was mediating the sort of high-minded ideas in the alt-right, the people like Richard Spencer, people like Jared Taylor, I mean, like the Kevin McDonald, the sort of intellectuals, and then I don't want to say proles, that sounds very elitist, but like, you know, like they're like common people, right? Like, so sort of making the sort of like high-minded ideas very accessible to people through memes. And specifically what I did was Disney parodies. So I mostly focused on like 90s era Disney films, the musicals from that era. And like Little Mermaid, Lion King. And I did, I think, probably about 50 in total. I forget the total number, but I got pretty big I think my peak subscriber count was like 50K or something like that. A few of my videos got like a few million views, but it was, I was ultimately banned in, I think, so my Twitter was banned in 2017. It was like right before Charlottesville. And that's kind of when I sort of, it effectively like silenced me as a public figure, because Twitter is where we all sort of were. And I kind of came back a few times, but I never really got as big or really had the same kind of like network or influence that I had originally. And then my YouTube was, I stopped making content for YouTube in 2017, but I was still sort of active, on Twitter. But then after I fell off Twitter, I still had the YouTube, but that was banned in 2018. So I basically disappeared from everything in 2018. I did a short-lived podcast like right before I got banned in 2018 with my roommate at the time, but that didn't that didn't really take. Since then I've been basically just completely removed from everything, right? And I've tried to pay attention to kind of what's going on, but to be honest, I haven't really been that plugged into the DR. I still kind of consider myself a man of the alt-right, and it's kind of interesting. I think that a lot of the values and sensibilities and sort of like aesthetics of the alt-right, I still kind of channel that in my current work and my current attitude. I think that the DR has kind of gone in a particular direction, and I'm not even necessarily opposed to it. I'm not like kind of counter-signaling at all. It just it's not really something that resonates with me, and I still kind of feel like I'm in that alt-right era myself. So I think that because I disappeared from everything right before Charlottesville, right? Like I think most people from that era, like that had a pretty big impact on them. So I think it didn't really have that same sort of impact on me. So I think that I still like look at a lot of the, aesthetic strategies of the alt-right, a lot of the sort of like metapolitical strategies. And I see that a lot. My contention is that a lot of them were, especially in 2015 and early 2016, before the influx of a ton of people into the movement after, I think, Trump's nomination was when it really exploded. I think that, during that era, we were making all the right moves, and we had a lot of really sort of genius oblique tactics that I think ultimately helped Trump get elected and ultimately really opened the door for, I would say, white identitarianism or soft white nationalism, like into mainstream right-wing politics. And, these days you have somebody like Charlie Kirk, you have somebody like Yeah. I mean, even somebody like Ben Shapiro, like, is much less anti-white, is much less sort of hypocritical about the whole Israel thing that he sort of used to be 10 years ago, right? And I think it's you know, I don't think people give the alt-right enough credit for that. I think that, you know, people talk about how the DR is connected to J.D. Vance. People talk about, you know, various, you know, sort of esoteric connections that go on there. But I think not enough people give the alt-right credit for sort of kicking down the door metapolitically to make these things. I mean, like every intellectual young conservative these days has been exposed to like race and IQ, right? Has been exposed to, you know, like questions of like dual morality, of dual loyalty, right? I mean, like these are things that are just in the waters that nobody can ignore. And I think that's because of the alt-right. And I felt like for a long time, it wasn't being given real credit for that. And there was this idea that the alt-right failed or that it was sort of defeated at Charlottesville. And I guess one of the reasons I came back this year, it was actually the very first thing I wrote. And this is the essay I actually sent you. Earlier this year, we had a brief correspondence about it. It was why the alt-right won or how the alt-right won. And it was the first thing I published on Substack. And it sort of like put me back on the map, I guess. Like Kanania promoted it pretty aggressively. And I guess like this is what my contention was basically that like the alt-right was in a sense victorious in the sense that it sort of served as like a sin eater. Right. In the sense that like everyone said it was sort of like destroyed at Charlottesville. But in a sense, it kind of absorbed all the negative energy, all the sort of animus. And in a sense, it allowed the DR to kind of come in more, again, more obliquely, more sort of in a decentralized fashion, promote a lot of the same ideas. And I think it's just important that we remember that intellectual heritage. Right. And I think, you know, I really value Millennial because this is one of the few institutions that is sort of like connecting the AR and DR. Right. That like it's been like an excellent institution for almost a decade. And it sort of like serves as one of the like few points of commonality. So I'm happy to come in here and like sort of like talk about, I guess, both the alt-right and I guess my kind of vision for the future, which is through the Tortuga Society. But I guess, you know, I've been sort of rambling for a few minutes. Maybe I'll pass it back to you to see if there's any like follow ups you want to make on that.
No, I think what you say is very kind and probably true that there's one of the few things that has survived from, I mean, yeah, there are websites, Countercurrents, Amren and so on that were there during the alt-right days. Millennial is another of those things and there aren't that many of them. So yeah, it's, I'm proud of that. But how about, why did you come back? And now at this juncture, that's probably a good jumping off point.
Oh yeah, sure. Well, I guess I felt like somebody needed to say this, and I felt like I was sort of like insulted that like nobody had like written a book, like sort of like chronicling like the history of the alt-right or something, or just kind of like putting it down in words. Like this was an important movement in history. This is important. Like I sort of want to like come back as a figure to sort of like just kind of do justice to my 23-year-old self, right? Because it's like I sort of felt like we were doing really important work back then, and like people don't necessarily value it as much these days, or people will put everything in the context of Charlottesville, which I think is just absurd. I mean, I think that like for instance, like the way we were able to do the this kind of like chain of edginess, right? Where you know, like somebody like Lauren Southern would talk to someone like Gavin McInnes, who would talk to someone like Jared Taylor, who would talk to someone like Richard Spencer, who would talk to someone like Kevin McDonald. And like, you know, like everyone would prevent themselves from like punching two steps right of themselves, but they would just like not acknowledge the existence of anyone two steps right of themselves, but they would always talk to someone one step to the right of themselves. And in doing so, it sort of like laundered everybody. Everybody sort of benefited. It was a sort of like collective strategy that I think we're able to execute like very intelligently. And I think also, I mean, just the sort of Modern Daily thing we pulled, Hillary calling, it was really the alt-right, a basket of deplorables, you know, like Joe Normie in Wisconsin thought she was talking about him, and that contributed to Trump's win. I mean, I think that not enough people give the alt-right credit for that. And I guess one of the reasons I wrote that initial essay was that I felt like, I mean, frankly, it just somebody needed to say that, right? And but then, you know, after I got some good reception with it, I realized that I could make pretty good money on Substack. And, you know, it's not that hard to build a paywall. And I saw what Hanania was doing. And, you know, I kind of like copied his model. you know, basically, it's like, you know, like it's hot takes that sell well, right? It's like sort of like sort of attacking both sides or like agreeing with liberals for the wrong reasons. It's like it's another, you know, great thing. You'll get like sort of high openness liberals who follow you, and like you can not only like get money, but you can also sort of like inject ideas into the discourse space, and you can I mean you can have like a pretty big outsized impact on Substack. Just, I mean, if you have like a few thousand people on Substack, you actually do have a pretty big impact on the discourse. I think Substack is actually one of the locations where ideas are sort of germinating these days.
Well, so, I was going to ask about Substack specifically, but I think I need to get a lot better at gaming the system, because maybe it's because I don't write hot takes. I see, I associate Twitter with hot takes and Substack with more considered work. But that's maybe what I'm doing with it.
You can do considered hot takes, right? I mean, like, you've got to, like, so for instance, like, I did pro-lifers are murdering babies. Right. So, like, I said that pro-lifers are responsible for, like, the death of back in the day, the median American did not support partial birth abortion. They supported, like, basically the Roe v. Wade thing. They would stop it in the second trimester. With the exceptions, but otherwise they would criminalize it. These days, the majority of Americans support abortion up to the point of birth. It's because of Republicans sort of overreaching on abortion. So it's like, you know. It's that kind of stuff that'll sell, right? It's like if you're aggressive towards people, but in a way that like benefits them, right? Like people will pay for it's like people will want to be challenged on Substack, right? Whereas I feel like on Twitter it's much more tribal. Like I feel like I'm called all sorts of, you know, like people don't like. Or I also did a pro-white case for reparations. Right. Like I was arguing for white nationalists, why they should support reparations. I was arguing it's essentially a poison pill. You can basically what I propose is like we exchange reparations in exchange for you do away with affirmative action. You do away with like the vast majority of the welfare state, and you tie it to black people like not committing any felonies. Right. So if they commit a felony, it's nullified. And if they commit a misdemeanor, it's frozen for 2 years. So this could be a way to sort of restrain black criminality, number one. But it's also a way to it's a way to essentially like banish the ghost of like white guilt, I think. And specifically, I'm targeting, like, I'm not targeting black people. I know they're never really going to forgive us for slavery, but it's more to make it like intolerable for like white women, like squishy suburban white women. You know, like when they started like doing the grievance mongering. So I won't go into like the details of the proposal, but like the basic idea was like you would get all the leaders of Black America to go on a stage and sign like this declaration of absolution. And, you know, in exchange for reparations, they say that they. Yeah, you see
that's
the idea.
That's a hilarious idea. Like, okay, we won't chimp out if you give us X amount of money. Exactly. And then we'll be well behaved.
Exactly. And it's like, they're going to break it, right? Like they're obviously not going to follow that, but you're gaming around that. And you're basically planning for like moderate white women who would otherwise fall into like the Black Lives Matter stuff, you know, in the post a black rectangle on Instagram. You're sort of making it a lot harder for them to do that. And I think that like, if you're, you know, you can sort of like pick off groups on the margins that way. And I think it's like, that's how the right needs to think. I feel like it's weird. Like a lot of people think that this kind of thinking is dishonorable. And it's like the same sort of people would have told Manstein to charge right into the Maginot Line, right? I mean, it's like they don't understand that like sometimes you have to be indirect. Sometimes like artistry and, you know, clever tactics and sort of, you know, like you look at the shadow of the thing, not the thing itself. And like that's how you can make the biggest impact in like as a propagandist, right? And that's how I'm sort of like looking at things. So I guess I got pretty, I guess, prominent earlier in the year. I was sporting a bunch of takes like that. But then I got sort of like, I guess bored of doing that. And I focus more on, I wrote some manifestos, like one was like the Barstool, right? Like I was trying to like argue. So we hear about like Barstool conservatism, right? It's like, basically Trump symbols, right? It's like not being very socially conservative, but like having, you know, like maybe you're opposed to the trans stuff. Maybe you're opposed to, you know,
it's like is it like old timey wisdom?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's sort of like the Joe Rogan impulse, like Dave Portnoy. It's like the like South Park Republican, maybe. It's kind of similar to that. So but it's like I'm trying to create a more intellectual version of that, you know, that has like sort of like firm precepts and everything. So like I did that, and then I did another one, How to Castrate the Left. And basically my idea is, you know, the left is this like sort of like loose coalition of all these different interest groups. Well, you know, like here's how we could like break off all these different groups. Like, so for instance, with women, you could get white women, like affluent white women, to start voting more Republican. If you were to, for instance, like Republicans could pass like a very like sort of onerous like nationwide revenge porn sort of ban or something like that. Or for instance, they could. What I propose is we concentrate the homeless in Western Nebraska. We build a large like complex to like put all the homeless people there, and it could be a rehabilitation center, a jobs training thing. Basically, it's a lot more scalable, right? If you have them all in one locale. And like right now, because they're just, these mayors are just like paying to send, you know, these homeless, like between different cities. Anyway, I know I'm, again, I'm probably talking very fast and rambling right now, but that's a, no, that was kind of, it was, those are the kind of ideas I was proposing. But then I guess at a certain point I was sort of like, well, I mean, I guess like I had like 7 or 6 years of ideas that were sort of backed up, and I hadn't really had any opportunities to really express them. But after I sort of like had the opportunity to do that, I sort of reached the conclusion, like, is anybody really going to, like, yeah, like ideas can percolate throughout the discourse space, but that takes time. And while Trump is in power, there's only so much that we can do to influence anything. Like if DeSantis were in power, I think I could actually get a white paper in front of him, and I could actually maybe influence policy. But with Trump, it's like whoever he just spoke to in the last 5 minutes is going to be determining the course of history, right? I mean, so it's sort of like, it's like how much can we really impact things? So that's why I moved in the direction of the Tortuga Society, which was like, I want to get our guys rich. Like basically I want right-wing white guys to get their own like personal financial situation shored up so that they are not under attack, that they, you know, they don't feel under a scarcity mindset, that they feel like they have agency over their own lives. And that's kind of what I've been focusing my efforts on over the past months. But yeah, my apologies. I know I've been dominating this, but like, did you have any thoughts on this?
Well, you are the interviewee, so that's okay. My job is just to keep you on topic. So as long as you're talking about things that are relevant to the audience, it's fine. I will ask you this. Do you think that, because this is something that is relevant to, a lot of people are wondering about this. Do you think that Substack is now kind of taken over from, or occupying the space that YouTube used to occupy in terms of freedom of speech, and the freedom to have ideas, to express ideas that are new?
Absolutely, yeah. I wouldn't, I mean, I don't even have a YouTube account at this point. I mean, after what they did to me before, I'm just like, I'll never trust them again. You know, it's like all the work that I put into that just completely obliterated. Like over
50, you said you had 50k. I had 57k, so that's bloody near what I had. And it's a lot of work. I mean, you put a lot of work into your songs, into your music. It is a sickening thing. I don't want to dwell on this because I think there's a lot of new stuff to go into here, but it's worth saying. I mean, they really did destroy a lot of people's livelihoods and bodies of work, and it's really sickening.
It is. And it's not even just like for me, it was really my friend group more than anything. Like, I mean, I mean, obviously I would have people at work who I would hang out with or school or whatever, like throughout the years, but it was really like the alt-right was, I don't know, like it sort of like taught me to be like socially normal in a sense. I mean, like that's where I met like my first like really close friends who were like intellectual peers. It's where I got my first girlfriend. It's where I sort of like was, you know, seen as a leader for the first time. And it's like, it was so, and that's why like when people talk about the alt-right as this heinous thing, or they, you know, like try to act like it was a failure. I can't even, like, to me, the alt-right was like an unalloyed good, right? Like, I can't even see it. I mean, like, I know a lot of people have traumas about like Charlottesville and doxing and everything like that, but I guess I sort of like escaped unscathed. So I was sort of one of the lucky ones, but I guess like for me, like looking back, it's sort of how I became a man in like every meaningful sense. And, yeah, I mean, like I can't think anything negative about the alt-right, and I can't, I don't know, like any of those social media companies that sort of like acted against me, I'll never, like, even if there is a change of leadership, I just don't, there's a sense in which it feels like cursed, I guess. I guess like Substack feels it's fresh. Like I know the guy, Chris Best. I mean, I haven't like spoken to him personally, but I've like messaged him, the guy who owns it. And he seems like legit. He seems like he actually, like I've actually like lobbied him to like unban people. And he like did it. So it's like, I know he's like good. Right. And I can trust him. And I think that, like, you know, like I after what happened to me before, like I need to have that sort of like personal connection with an owner before I feel like I can really invest like that much of my, because yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, it was literally just like years of my life. It was like destroyed or something. I don't know. I guess the good thing is people save the videos and they put them on like BitChute or whatever, but it's like, you know, like the view count. Like, I guess like I did drive a lot of sort of self-esteem as a 24-year-old from, you know, the view count on YouTube. So
yeah, it's not the general public on BitChute or Odyssey or any of the others. And that is the bummer with YouTube, because it remains the video sharing website. But as I was saying to someone last night, I think that X, Twitter, is poised to take over there. Mm. Do you have any? If you're not on Twitter, then you probably won't have much to say about that. But it just seems to me that YouTube is sort of old hat at this point. It's certainly for anything like our stuff, you know, yeah. Any kind of political content.
No, I agree. I am on Twitter, but I only sort of use it to promote my stuff, and I'm not good at Twitter anymore. Like, I used to be good at Twitter, but I feel like I don't know. Like, I haven't kept up with my. Like, I'm good at Substack because maybe I've just become an old man or something. I don't know. But like, I feel like I can't write like punchy tweets anymore. Whereas I feel like I can, you know, I can do like the long form stuff more effectively. But I feel like it's a very certain type of verbal intelligence, like being able to like, you know, craft good tweets or something. But or maybe it's just like I'm out of practice. I don't know. But like, it definitely is like sort of like juicing the algorithm in a certain way. Whereas I feel like on Substack, it does like genuinely reward substance in a way that, I mean, both YouTube and Twitter, like it's so much is about like algorithmic optimization. It's like, you know, I mean, is that what you really want to be focused on as a creator? So.
Yeah, indeed. Substack lends itself more to, I think, what the kind of thing that you and I, in our different ways, want to do, which is to cultivate like a fan base of like-minded people who will then take those ideas in their own directions and so on. People who are sincere, people who actually do give a shit. Right. Whereas on YouTube, I mean, a lot of people, it's sort of like passing trade, as it were. It's people who, a lot of them, I'm not saying all of them, but a lot of them, you know, they could be watching me or they could be watching Jordan Peterson. Right. Which hardly bears thinking about, but I think for a lot of people that there is that sort of latitude because they're not that committed. I think Substack rewards more commitment.
It's a very sort of middle class sort of platform too, in the sense that like it sort of like puts everyone in the same, like it feels like there's less of a distance between a commenter and a you know, like somebody who's writing a publication on Substack than like on YouTube or Twitter. You know, a content creator versus a commenter, there's like a huge difference. And like, I remember when I was on YouTube, like I would not take seriously anybody who didn't make their own content. I was like, you know, screw you. Like if you're not making content, like you're just like, I'm not going to take your opinion seriously because the amount of effort it takes to post like a good video versus like, you know, just like some shitpost comment. The same thing I guess with Twitter, I mean, it's all kind of like one medium, right? Whereas with Substack, I feel like, you know, like there are people who post like really thoughtful comments in the comment section of one of my essays, and I sort of feel like they're sort of on the same level as me, right? So like I sort of feel like I have to engage them more honestly and more directly, and I feel like that it prevents audience capture and it prevents like perverse incentives as a content creator and as a, you know, leader in a movement. Like it sort of like holds you accountable more. It means you actually have to produce good content. Like there have been times when I mean, I have sort of caught myself like treating Substack like it was, you know, one of the other sleazier sort of platforms, and I was sort of like adopting more of a, you know, scalability mindset of like trying to get as many eyeballs as possible. But then it's like, those pieces get like less engagement. Like you actually have to, on Substack, it actually has to be good. And if it's good, it'll get engagement. If it's not, it won't. And that's, it's kind of scary in a sense, because it sort of like forces you, you know, you can't just kind of like game the system like you can on other sites. But it does, I think, obviously, you know, promote the better content at the end of the day. And that's what we want. So, I mean, yeah, I would encourage everybody to get on Substack if they're not, and, you know, start, because the thing is, another thing about Substack is like people write at all different levels of complexity. I mean, there's also like different, I mean, like I do poems, I do, you know, like short stories, I do essays. I mean, I do all sorts of content, and you can publish whatever. Now, of course, you'll have people in your fan base who are like, well, why aren't you, you know, only writing essays? That's what I subscribe to you for. But it's like, you know, like they can unsubscribe. It's fine. But
yeah. All right. So let's get then to the Tortuga Society and what that is and how it works towards your goals.
Yeah, sure. So the Tortuga Society is I guess you could call it a professional fraternity or a fraternal organization, kind of something similar to, I guess the classic thing would be the Freemasons, right? But, you know, you could think of like the Elks or the Knights of Columbus or something like that, right? Like that's what we're sort of like modeling it after. Basically, the idea is it's a group of guys who are we define it as right wing white guys and their allies, right? So it's not like an overtly white nationalist organization, and we do have non-white members, but they're you know, I audit everybody to make sure they're cool and that they're like aligned with us, and you know, we have pretty robust OPSEC stuff, so you know, like people don't have to be concerned about that if they're interested in joining. I can go through all that, you know, with people individually if they're interested. I don't think you know, it would make sense to go through all the OPSEC procedures here on the on the episode. But what I will say is that, you know, we take that very seriously. But what I'll also say, though, is that we're not, like, I don't know, I sort of feel like in the sort of political ecology of 2024, we're actually not at like a cancelable level. Like I sort of will talk about like being pro-white in a sort of mainstream right-wing context, and I feel like it's like okay these days, right? So like I don't really feel like it's something that people would even have to be that sort of concerned about. That said, what you might want to be concerned about is what we're what our actual like object level tactics are, which is we define our mission as plundering corporate America, or ransacking woke corporations. So the idea is, if you look at modern corporate America, it is built off of rent seeking and grifting. You have like the consulting industry, which is incredibly extractive. You have a lot of those companies like McKinsey or like the Big Four. I mean, they're also auditors, and there's companies want to get in. I mean, like you can't be audited and get this same firm as your consultant, but generally speaking, they just want to have a positive relationship with all of those firms, right? And same thing with like McKinsey, it has a lot of sort of like lobbying clout. Like really, a lot of these corporations will pay massive consulting fees to a lot of these firms that aren't really delivering real value. It's really just an enormous waste. And like anybody who's actually been in corporate America can attest to that. There's also bullshit jobs, right? So David Graeber, he wrote the book about that. It's quite famous. I have my critiques of that, but the basic idea is a lot of work in modern corporate America is a complete waste of time, because a lot of roles are sort of created not for any actual purpose, but rather to fulfill a political objective. So for instance, a manager might want to have more direct hires or direct like subordinates under him because it sort of increases his clout within the organization, right? Or you might have different organizations that are feuding and they're sort of like hiding resources or information from one another. And because of that, there's responsibilities that get siloed off and there's not, and sort of efficient scalability. So because of that, you get a lot of internal redundancy in a lot of these corporations. Because of that, there's a lot of opportunities to take advantage of those sort of like cracks, right? To sort of like stick a crowbar take your share. And what I'm trying to say is that guys in our thing need to be willing to do that because other groups are. And, that's something that back in the old right days, we would always talk about the JQ. These days, people are talking more about like the Brahmin question, right? There's in Silicon Valley, Indian immigrants tend to be very overrepresented, and they'll oftentimes engage in sort of like nepotistic practices, like hiring. I mean, sometimes just directly family members, but oftentimes like just co-ethnics. There is that sort of like collaboration behind the scenes. And basically, what I'm positing is that white guys need to be doing the same thing. And even back in the alt-right days,
I completely agree. I just want to sorry to interrupt your flow there, but I just want to say I totally agree. I think that anyone at this point who has any scruples about doing that is a fucking idiot, because we absolutely have to be nepotistic. Otherwise, we're just going to get eaten alive. I mean, I've heard stories from so many different people, especially in America, about how one Indian gets in control of, like, he becomes the HR manager at a company, and then 2 years later he has replaced everyone with Indians. This kind of thing. If you think that we've got to be principled or something in response to that, you're not going to make it.
You'll get completely wrecked. It's just basic sort of game theory. But I guess the sort of difficulty is, I think that in Western civilization in general, but especially in sort of like Anglo, sort of culture, like there's a certain stigma against that sort of behavior, right? I mean, even like Irish and Italian, like they sort of like stop doing that, like very sort of like early on in their immigrant journeys. So I think that we don't really have a lot of familiarity with like how to go about doing that sort of thing in practice, right? So I think that what Tortuga has been trying to do is reestablish that ethos, right? And hold on, let me pull up my notes so I can just mention everything we're doing. There's a ton of different like asymmetric strategies we're helping guys leverage, right? So number one is job stacking, and this is sort of like the main selling point that I was sort of using as a wedge to sort of like build the organization and get people interested in the beginning, because it's like the most immediately attractive. And a lot of people have heard of job stacking. It's basically you're working multiple remote jobs for different companies, and they don't know. Right. So like oftentimes you'll have multiple bullshit jobs. These are email jobs where, you're doing maybe like 2 to 5 hours of work a week. You get paid maybe 80 to 120K. If you're a software engineer, maybe you're getting paid 200 grand for it. And then, if you can just collect multiple salaries. Why not? Right. And it's actually, so I can speak from personal experience. I was in the consulting world. I was at Deloitte. I was working probably 80-hour weeks most of the year, 120-hour weeks during busy season. You know, when I went back into industry, you know, I my salary went down maybe 30%, but my stress level went down probably, you know, like 90%. But then when I started job stacking, instead of like my credentialing was in actuarial, but so I had like one managerial level actuarial job. I instead took a individual contributor level actuary job. And then I had two data analyst jobs on top of that, which are much easier, much less credential heavy. They don't really require advanced credentialing, right? They're very fungible. They pay like 90 to 120 grand, but you know, they're very easy to get. I was able to make like three times as much with probably like half as much work as being a manager. And that's the main thing you arbitrage, right? Is in corporate America, becoming a manager and sort of accepting those more complex higher order responsibilities and having to be in more meetings, accepting all that additional cognitive load, the juice is not worth the squeeze. And we're entering into a world of increasing asymmetries, wherein it's not going to be like people just getting a sinecure, you know, like really like the existing system. You have a lot of people who have these bullshit jobs who do have a fairly high salary, but they're not really like, there's not much of a value add because the work is very Pareto distributed. It's only a few guys in the department doing everything, but you sort of need this as a UBI for the upper middle classes, for overeducated elite, right? As a sort of way to sustain the system. But like, basically job stacking and other sort of asymmetries that were enabled by remote work that are going to be enabled soon by AI, that's going to shift the labor market into a direction that I think that the right wing should leverage, because it's really going to be just a very small number of people who I believe are going to be collecting almost all of the benefits from the system, right? And a lot of people are essentially going to be either out of work or they're going to be given like some sort of like effective UBI or some sort of like effective make work job, you know, if something like that is sort of like fashioned. But like it's still sort of up in the air as to what's going to happen. But AI is already, you know, eliminating a lot of those junior level coding jobs and data analyst jobs. So this is something we have to get our arms around. And like what I'm proposing is like job stacking is a way for guys on the right to, for instance, you know, like make it so your wife doesn't have to work, right? Like maybe you know, right now you're both making like 80 grand, but like you could get two jobs instead and she can quit her job and, you know, watch the kids. Maybe you could send your kids to a private school. Maybe you could get a better house. You know, like there's obviously, like even if you're not materialistic, like there's always things you can do with more money. And I think that like the main point is we need to make sure that those resources are going to our guys as opposed to, you know, Redditors who'll just spend it on Funko Pops and marijuana or whatever. Right. So
yes.
I think that like that's kind of my general impulse. So job stacking is one of them. Another one is, I mean, you can just lie in your resume, right? Like there's nothing really stopping you. The thing is, like you can't lie about credentials or like your diploma, but you can lie about work experience. So long as there is a, like a website for the business that you're listing. And we've created dummy websites, like dummy companies. Like we've actually like created the companies, like they're filed, right? So they're on the books, like in the States. And we'll say that you worked for, if you're a member of the Tortuga Society, we'll say that you worked for us and we'll create very plausible experience on your resume. So you can pass an interview with flying colors, right? That's one of the benefits you'll get from being part of the Tortuga Society. Another thing we do, we have a staffing firm, an external staffing firm. We'll place your ass directly into a role because we have leads. We have guys like, right now we have 100 guys in the group, but we have like a bunch more guys in our just general network, right? We have guys all throughout corporate America who have, I mean, like some of these are like impressive guys. Some of them are like boomers who've like been in, you know, been around for quite some time and have a pretty impressive LinkedIn, right? So we're getting all sorts of leads for to place guys in. And once our staffing firm is up and running, which it should be in a few weeks, we're going to be able to directly place guys into roles. And that'll both get a lot of revenue into Tortuga as an organization, because whenever you place someone, you get like 10, 20 grand, right? So that's going to go directly into our pocket, like right out of the firm. And then we'll place our guys into roles and then they can, and then it becomes a snowball, right? Because then they can place guys once they're sort of embedded in all these teams. Like this is how I would argue that a lot of those secret societies back in the day, like the Freemasons or whatever, operated. You know, like I think you need to seize institutional power in a lot of these organizations and, you know, be able to place your guys there to extract resources from the system. And I think a lot of other ethnic groups do that. And I think a lot of other religious organizations do that. And essentially I'm proposing this as something for the alt-right.
I think that a lot of people might find this kind of thing a bit alien to them, because we're so accustomed to abstractions and also just more honest work, so to speak. Right. But I think the thing is that's why we're poor. I mean, we have to be realistic about this. As much as I admire honesty and I value it and I hope that I've been very honest, I think that is why our movement is poor. Ultimately, money is an enabler. It's a fuel. It's freedom. And it means options and so forth. And every other group is prepared to do this kind of thing. While we talk about principles, as I said earlier. So, I mean, I'm not advocating that people should be grossly dishonest, or certainly not that they should do anything illegal. I'm just saying we should leverage what we have as effectively as we can. Everyone else does it.
Right, exactly. And I'll say job stacking is not illegal. Sometimes a contract will prevent you from, like, they'll have you sign a non-compete or whatever, but that would be a tort. It wouldn't be a criminal offense. And like, it's almost never worth it to, for them to, like, go again. Like, they're just going to fire you in, like, the vast majority of cases, right? Like, unless you're, like, some sort of, like, senior level executive or something. I mean, like, it's not going to be worth it for them to go after you in any way. Really, it's all about learning how to game the HR department. And we actually have a guy in the group. Oh, so this is the really cool thing. We have a guy in the group who's, like, a son of one of the most, like, distinguished legal experts in the country. He is, this guy's very, he's a character. I actually did a podcast episode with him. It's called The Count. I can anybody who's interested, they can DM me. Or you can just look at my Substack. It was just a few episodes back. Well, this guy is suing companies that he's working at for discrimination against white men. And he's like, you can get away with that these days, and like, you can actually, like, collect money. Not a lot of people know that, but it's like illegal, and like their companies are settling with guys, like, and he's gotten like a 5-figure payout, right? For there was at his company, they were doing a thing where it was like a training program for only Hispanics or something, and he did an EEOC complaint, and because it went through, it was a settlement, right? So he got like five figures out of it. But
what does EOC stand for, just so that I know?
The Equal Opportunity Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, I think.
Right, okay, thanks.
Yeah. So that's actually something, it's another sort of business line that we have where we're going to be. So I've already started, like, putting together the infrastructure for this. We're going to be sending out resumes to companies, like, to woke, tech companies or whatever. We'll have our own resume, which will be a perfectly qualified white guy resume. Then we're going to submit another one, like Shaniqua Jackson, right? And then another one, like Isabella Hernandez or whatever, right? If they're, it's going to be very similar to our resume, but slightly worse. The GPA is slightly worse. The experience is slightly worse. The formatting is slightly worse, right? And then if they get a call back, but we don't, we're going to put forward an EEOC complaint. And that could be like, yeah, that could be a pretty big payout, right? If we get the right lawyer. So, like, we have our fingers in a lot of different pies right now. But that's another thing that we're sort of pushing on, because that could really form the basis of, like, an entire civil rights organization, right? I mean, that's a sort of, like, it's like Rosa Parks shit. So I would really like and I think with the Trump administration, that's a sort of way to sort of, like, leverage that, because they're going to be appointing a lot of favorable judges, and you're going to have favorable executive decisions. So, I'm looking forward to leveraging that a lot. But I guess for me, the main thing really is just the community, because we have a Telegram group. It's over 100 guys now, and really agentic, high quality guys. I mean, a lot of them are, I'd say, like, half our guys are like remote workers, right? They have some sort of STEM job. I actually have analytics on this. You can look at my Substack. I published a thing on our membership analytics recently. But basically, half of our guys are currently doing remote work. About 20 of them, I think, are job stacking right now, or maybe like 15. Then, like, half of the guys are like liberal arts majors or blue collar guys who are specifically training in, like, SQL and Python and Tableau to get, like, a data analytics role, because we have, like, a boot camp affiliated with us too, that we can, like, once you join the society, it's a very, like, lightweight sort of self-directed boot camp that can get you to a point where you can get a close to 6-figure data analyst job if you use our experience fabrication infrastructure correctly. And so the idea is, we could find a 120 IQ plumber or, philosophy major or something, and say he's worked as a data analyst for us for the past 3 years, train him so he's actually capable of doing that, and then he can go make 80, 90 grand, right? And if we get like every white nationalist in the country who's like smart enough to do that, doing that, and then they can start like gentrifying neighborhoods, they can start contracting with like private intelligence firms that can dox Antifa, right? They can start donating to their local like political organizations. They can start funding right wing art. I mean, there's a million things you can do with this. And I have a lot of really bold ideas, but I mean, as you can probably tell, it's a lot of stuff that, you know, I'm trying to like focus on the immediate, like getting the revenue in and getting our membership up and making sure we have the right OPSEC. But I think that if this goes correctly, and if white boys are able to pull off what like Jews and Indians have been doing, we were the Roman Empire, right? We can do the same thing, right? And like that's my goal.
That's amazing. I don't know what to say to that because it's so open and energetic and optimistic. I mean, it's great to hear. And it sounds like it's already successful. I mean, this is not, you're not just talking hypothetically here.
Oh no, I quit my jobs, right? I mean, I'm like living off this now, right? Because the membership fees are like supporting me, and it's like a business, right? So, it's already like scalable, and I'm able to like dedicate all my time to it. I have an equity partner who is another guy, a little bit younger than me, who's his technical skills are much better than mine, and he's a lot more sort of grounded. I mean, I'm a very like Steve Jobs kind of guy, I'm very big into sort of like driving the strategic vision. But my COO Theon. He's very like practical, and he's very down to earth, and he's a great administrator. And he's gotten us set up. Like we have like four different businesses now, affiliated with our thing that are set up. It's going ahead at full steam. We have 100 guys, really agentic, really. I mean, it's a very active Telegram group. If you want to join, obviously it's not free, right? I mean, I was able to quit my job because I'm charging people for this, but one of the reasons I'm charging people too is, I want to make sure that, people have skin in the game. It's important that you have a filtration mechanism, you have a curation mechanism, that you're only bringing in the right sort of guys. Because my thing is, both when it comes to like people and when it comes to content, I feel like curation and like the curatorial impulse is the most important thing these days. I mean, AI and like mass communication is basically like there's an unlimited amount of people and an unlimited amount of content now. And it's about like, how do you find the right people? How do you, like, I'm not interested in, like, back in the old days, I had like 50,000 subscribers and that was great. But if anything, I'm more influential now on Substack with 2,400 followers than I was back in the old days with 50,000, because, I'm influencing people who write essays themselves, right? And then like, that sort of like disseminates out into the wider universe. And it's sort of, I don't know, quality over quantity, really, these days. Once you just have AI, crap, like flooding everything, it's all about, can you curate? And we're curating pretty aggressively with Tortuga. Like both the fact that we're advertising really only on Substack, which is, you sort of just get that higher quality of guy. And then I'm making sure that people pay a membership fee, number one. And I'm also, I'm doing an intake call with every member. So I'm sort of auditing them to make sure they're cool and making sure they can pull their weight, that they can eat what they kill, right? Because I'm also expanding the organization. My whole business model has been, if you can produce revenue for the Tortuga Society, I'll let you use the branding and we'll do a revenue sharing split. Cause I want my guys to get rich through this too. Now, I mean, I intend to become the richest, but I intend for my guys to get rich too. And, so I'm always going to take a taste of it, but I want to make sure that, that we have a good incentive structure, right? That we, our incentives are aligned in the right direction and that we are, all sort of like sailing in the same direction. We're all like a sort of coherent armada. Right. And, I think we've done that pretty effectively. Now, obviously, as we scale and as we, we're going to hit MVP status on January 1st and, we're going out of beta. So we're going to be doubling our membership fee. Right now it's $250. It's going to be $500, as of January 1st. And I'm going to start advertising a lot more aggressively at that point. At that point we're going to have our experience fabrication infrastructure already. We're going to have the staffing firm already. And I think we're just going to be good to go. And I think $500 to join an organization where, if we get you a six-figure job, it's like the return is just like straightforwardly, worth it. Right. So I won't feel, people have called me a grifter or whatever, but it's like, I felt like insecure about that in the past. And I've published interviews of my guys like saying like, yeah, like welcome me a job. Right. So like, I have proof that it's like legit. Right. If you want to go to my Substack, I have like tons of evidence that we've been like scoring points on the board. But I guess like at this juncture, like, everything is legit. Everything is real enough that I don't feel insecure anymore. And I feel like it is just straightforwardly an organization that is like producing very sizable returns for our guys. And I see no reason not to be exuberant. And that's sort of like what I want to enable is that like, I sort of came into this thing, the alt-right, into that culture of exuberance. And I sort of missed that. And I feel like the dissident right has become very dour. It's become very black-pilled. It's become very, I feel like, in a sense, like abrogating your own agency, abrogating your own ability to like impact your life outcomes. I mean, like I was able to get fairly rich and just by sort of like taking advantage of corporate America. And I don't know, like it wasn't like terribly hard. I think if you have a 130 IQ and you're, you know, hardworking and you're willing to sort of like be creative, it's not terribly hard. And you know, we're willing to sort of like help guys get there. Right. So, I mean, I think I don't want guys in our movement to think of themselves as like Rosa Parks. I want them to think of themselves as like Hernan Cortez or like Vasco da Gama. Like, we're going to go out and conquer. We're going to go out and like take from them. And that's what the alt-right's attitude was. It was aggressive. Whereas I feel like the DR's attitude has been very sort of defensive. It's been very, it makes sense. It's guys are traumatized after Charlottesville. I mean, after the doxings and everything, like it makes sense for people to be. But I guess because I never had that happen to me, I sort of have, I don't know, like I've never really been punished for like being racist. You know, like I'll just like openly talk about race and IQ, you know, with like a girl on a date or like even, you know, I've even spoken about it with like bosses and I'd like, it's been fine. So I also live in Florida, which is like a very sort of like open apology for that. So I suppose like for me, I sort of feel like we're on, like, I feel like we, like it's like the past few years, we've just been making a lot of progress. And
I agree with what you're saying, but I don't think it's a good idea to try to own that word of being racist, because maybe I'm speaking from the British context here, because it seems to me that that is effectively a synonym for evil at this point. And so this was one of the mistakes actually of the alt-right. The thinking was, well, they're calling us that, so let's just be that, or let's just say we're that. But that actually works against you, because you're now playing the role that they've written for you. But that's my own problem.
I think it depends on the way you frame it. Like, I think that, like, I'll tell like a black guy, like my Uber driver, that I'm like racist, and like, he'll like laugh, because it's like clearly like it's a sort of like plausible deniability thing, right? Like, it's a sort of like meta modern thing where you can sort of like be like serious and like you can be the sort of earnest and ironic at the same time, and that's another thing that alt-right was good at. And like, I think a lot of people are sort of like rewriting history. I'm not saying you're doing this, but I think that a lot of people like get blackpilled about like what happened in 2017. Like, okay, my opinion is everything before Hailgate was like fine. Like, I think that like our tactics were almost like perfectly good, right? Like, and I think we used irony very well. I mean, like, I remember my buddy and I were going around Disney World doing like the Roman salutes, and like it was like fine. The girls were like laughing at it. It was like, I don't know, like before Charlottesville and everything, it was sort of fine. Like, it was really the marches that I think killed us, in my opinion.
Yeah, I do think the marches were a huge mistake, and I can't remember what I thought about them at the time, but I don't want to rewrite history, but I do remember shortly after the marches saying that was a mistake, because it's playing the role that they've written for us of, you know, the horrible neo-Nazis marching. Don't they look terrifying? Don't they look stupid? Don't they look blind and hate-filled and all that? It's just a mistake. It's just, anyway.
Well, let me ask you about that. I need to press you on this, because I'm a little curious. So I feel like, in my opinion, what really went wrong was that we became a little bit too populist. Like, I feel like we became, and I'm not saying that, like, you know, I'm not like super elitist or anything. All I'm saying is that when I think of the alt-right in 2015, right, when I think of like Spencer's original, do you remember that it was the MPI conference where he invited like Donovan? It was a big controversy over that. There was like the fat black guy who got like, they were like spraying people with this like silly string outside. When I think of that, like, it was a bunch of like really like good looking, like educated, like guys in suits who made like a really great impression to the world. And like, they were edgy. They were aggressive. They didn't really like mince words, but it was sort of like, because it was coded as high status, like it was seen as like subversive. Like, it was seen as attractive. And like, you had like liberal journalists who were writing like very favorable like think pieces about the alt-right for like quite some time into 2016. Now, like, eventually it stopped. But like, my contention would be that was more because the alt-right lost its sort of elite coding, as opposed to it was seen as like threatening. Because I think like being seen as aggressive or being seen as I think that that was like a sort of advantage the alt-right had over the dissident right, is that like we were able to be seen as the aggressor, but in a way that was glamorous, in a way that, I mean, even when you say like alt-right, it's bisyllabic. It's like punchy. It has a punchy mouthfeel. Dissident right, it feels a little like awkward. It's like justifying itself too much, right? It doesn't feel like self-confident, whereas alt-right, it's like it's confident in what it is. And
it's ballsy. Yeah, I agree.
Exactly. Yeah.
It was a name I always liked. I really liked that name. And I still do. I don't want to get too much into that. But what I will say, picking up on something you said earlier, I think that people were traumatized by Charlottesville, but especially after that, the censorship that followed that. Mm-hmm. Again, I might be speaking from my own experience, but I think it affected a lot of people. The threat that everything you've built could just be toppled, just deleted in an instant. And eventually it did happen to almost all of us. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, that does shake you. I mean, the reason I hardly made any videos in 2018 and 19 was this. You know, it was like having a gun pressed against your head. Mm-hmm. And at any moment you could say the wrong word and the trigger's pulled. It was fucking awful. It was a terrible, terrible position to be in. But I think you're right that then COVID happened. That was, I think, worse in Europe than it was in America. But certainly, again, traumatized, that sounds a very strong word to use, but it did. People were shaken after that. And it still hasn't recovered. So what I wanted to pick up on was what you said, that the alt-right was very ballsy, the dissident right is more sort of reserved, careful, watchful, and it's understandable, but it can't stay like that forever. I mean, we can't just be the crowd who were beaten by progressive liberalism in 2019. There has to be another chapter. And this is why I applaud what you're doing, because without knowing the ins and outs of it, it sounds like a really good idea, because it sounds like seizing that energy, getting that optimism back, and in a more organized way than before, when it was really sort of just bravado and faking it till you make it. You're talking about doing something that's more long-lasting and enduring.
Yeah, I like the idea of like, I've used the metaphor of building a castle, right? I think that something I've just observed is that when I was younger, I think back when I was like 22, right? I was still like so close to the university. I mean, I graduated college fairly early, so I had been out of college for a little while by then, but I was still, you know, not very far removed from it. And I guess I was still like an incel. I was kind of a neet. I wasn't making good money at the time. And it's like, you know, when you don't really have any status or anything to yourself, like it feels like so hyper salient. Like all of the woke stuff just feels so existentially oppressive. But it's like after I started, not to be crass, but like, you know, like getting laid and I had money and I had like something for myself in life, like I didn't care as much or like it's, and I don't want to like promote everyone doing the boomer grill pill thing. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is like, I think that there's a certain extent to which like, it's almost like agorism. It's like everybody can individually, you know, make themselves anti-fragile. They can create a situation for themselves where like it doesn't matter as much if there are, you know, thermostatic shifts in the national political climate and there might be some sort of like censorship regime. Like if we have our own institutions, I mean, you know, the right's been talking about parallel institutions for a long time. But I think that really when we talk about parallel institutions, it has to be something that gets you money. Right. And my problem with our fundraising approach is that it's either like asking everybody and their grandma for $5 or asking like Peter Thiel, you know, for like a billion. It's like, I feel like, you know, like the left, if you look at like the effective altruists, they have a bunch of like programmers who just make like 400 grand a year. Who'll just like give, you know, 20 or 30 grand to like all their stupid malaria nets things. It's like, well, why can't we have that for, you know, for our stuff? Like the problem is that our guys are, I guess like less rich, as you were sort of like saying, but like, I think that there are a lot of guys in the DR who do have money, who do have like good STEM jobs or whatever, but I think that they don't like they tend to be, the sort of guys who don't think like this.
Like well, I can tell you that the predominant personality type, if you go by Myers-Briggs in the alt-right was, I think this was around 2019 and it was, INTJ by a long way.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the sort of engineer, autist, programmer type.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, yeah, the All Right definitely was. I mean, I guess it's sort of hard for me to say, when we talk about the dissident right, it can mean a lot of different things, right? Like, like when I think of the alt-right, it was very, I think that the important thing about the alt-right was that it was very sort of metapolitically intelligent. And I think you had a lot of people who had like a humanities or arts education. I mean, including me, like I majored in philosophy. Now I ended up in STEM because I wanted to make money later. But I mean, it's like, you know, I had that. But like, you were an art student, right? Originally.
Yes, yes, I was. It's different in Britain. We don't major and minor. We just do one subject usually, right. Unless it's some, I guess you can do joint degrees and stuff as well. Yeah, I went to art college. Big mistake.
Well, see, the thing is, I don't know. I guess like my thing is I sort of like look at this sort of division we have intellectually between like people who think of themselves as like humanities people, like writing people or artsy people, and then people who think of themselves as like math people or STEM people. And I don't like that because I feel like it sort of encourages sort of artsy fartsy or humanities people to like not be practical about like thinking about getting resources when like, you know, there's no reason you can't start a business with a philosophy degree. I mean, like I have, it's like, it's not like, I think it's not very helpful, but on the other hand, it also promotes sort of cultural illiteracy in people who have money. And I think part of the reason that everything's so ugly these days is that the people who have money don't have taste. You know, like there's that disconnect, but it's like, the thing is like people who have money are like desperate to acquire cultural capital, and people who have cultural capital are desperate to acquire money. I like part of what I want to do with Tortuga is for facilitating that interchange by making like both groups of guys like more competent in the other realm. So that's why there's a lot of like liberal arts majors and artsy guys in Tortuga who are like upskilling in SQL and stuff so they can get a data analytics job. And then, you know, they're probably going to donate a lot of their earnings to right wing art. Right. Or like funding their own stuff. And, you know, like that's always sort of been like my impulse, you know, and then on the other side, there are a lot of guys who are like STEM guys who already have money, who are, you know, they enjoy getting to like interact with those guys and sort of like becoming more culturally literate themselves. And then, you know, as it grows, you know, you get, you know, like all sorts of artsy people. Like it's a sort of just attractive milieu to be in. Right. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's that's how you build a scalable sort of organization is like you have to think about those like sort of arbitrage opportunities that are sort of being underserved. And I think, you know, I think especially on the right, there's a lot of that because like, there's the sort of like archetype of like the right wing humanist who just is completely pie in the sky, who doesn't have any practical whatever. But then you have like the STEM, like libertarian guy who just has no culture. I mean, it's like, I think we can bridge that, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's just a matter of building the infrastructure. And it's but that you see that sounds easy. It's not easy because you need the time, the effort, the skill, the inclination, the motivation, so to do anything. And so you know this is why money is important. So this is why I don't in any way go against what you were saying earlier. Everything. See, I'll tell you. I could rant about this. There's a lot that I could say about this, but it's. I'm not going to because it's your interview, but I'll say this. There's a certain mentality on the fringe right, or the whatever you want to call this. I think probably it applies on the left as well, but I'm not experienced with that. There's a certain mentality that, well, you should do it for the love of it. You should do it because it's true. You should do it for the cause. You should do it because you're genuinely committed. Well, we all are genuinely committed, but humans are humans. And this is why money is important. This is why funding is important. In the end, not much happens without money in the real world. And you can say that people should live on a shoestring. They should be poor. They should be poor and fucking hungry and desperate and committed. That is crazy.
Our enemy should be. We should drive them to poverty. Like we should use the wealth for ourselves. Yeah. And like, honestly, like another part of that is, I mean, like it just facilitates scalability, right? Like you can build a more, like, even if you're not like, you know, paying yourself a big salary or whatever. I mean, like you can invest more into your operations if you're like charging people stuff. Right. I mean, and people can get more of the content they want because you can hire people, you can invest in tools. I mean, it's like people who too have this, like people who call everyone a grifter who like charges or whatever, like they just, they've never like run anything. Like they have no leadership skills.
I'm not going to say anything. Just, I agree.
I mean, it's like, I don't know. I have so little respect for people like that. It's like, you know, people who've never created or never ran anything. It's like, why are you criticizing people who are, you know what I mean? But yeah, I mean, I'll say like, generally speaking, I think that there's been a lot more guys in the spaces who like, who have been like, you know, like incorporating it, like with their business. Right. Like I know my friend Marcelino, he's a Tradcath guy who runs I think it's called Sherwood Partners. Anybody, you can look him up, Marcelino D'Ambrosio. He's like a marketing consultant. He's also in Tortuga. He actually hired a guy like from Tortuga. So like, we're actually like staffing our own firms, like through the organization, like really, we need to be, like stop being opposed to making money or stop being opposed to like talking about money. Like this idea that it's like Jewish or whatever. It's like, okay, fine. Like the Jews run everything. So, I mean, like, yeah, like do it. Like, well, why not imitate the people who have power? I mean, you know?
Well, and also in the past, it wasn't, I mean, WASPs, they were concerned with money as well for sensible reasons. It's not just so that you can have a fucking jewel-plated jacuzzi in your house. It's so that you can do things in the world.
Right. Yeah, I mean, and I mean, frankly, like there's a lot, I mean, like just think about all the stuff that, all the legal stuff that happened to everybody. Right. Like if we had more money to like get top shelf lawyers or to get like private intelligence firms, you know, they could like blackmail those people. I mean, like there's like a lot of, you know, interesting stuff you can do when you actually have resources. And I don't know. Sorry.
Oh, yeah. Very much. I mean, the lawsuits that we could have done and that I rather foolishly tried to do at one point. That's a whole thing that I've never even talked about. But yeah, I did attempt that at one point on my own and lost a lot of my savings trying to do that. It was just inexperience, really. But the reason I mention it now is if we had had good funding, we could have launched lawfare on the people who were trying to oppress us at various points. Mm-hmm. And with sufficient funding, we could have won. Or at least we'd have had a damn good chance of winning. But we didn't, so they won. And it ultimately comes down to this. You know, you can say that power is abstract and it's owned by this or that, sure. But money only ever helps in this regard.
Yeah. I mean, it's like there's different levels too, right? I mean, if you're like going very overtly against the state, I mean, you're probably going to get crushed. But if you're or you know, if you're going against someone like Roberta Kaplan, I mean, it's kind of hard to fight against someone like that. But if you're fighting against like, you know, your HR department. It's like, you know, I mean, like just having access to like a good lawyer can like, you know, be the difference between like tens of thousands of dollars and like not, right? I mean, they're just like little things like that, like you can do to like increase your chances on the margins, or, you know, like make it so your wife doesn't have to work, or make it so your kids don't have to get bullied by black kids at school. I mean, like there's like a million things, right, that having money can help us with. And I just
why should we be miserable?
Yeah.
Like there's no, you see, this is the thing. I think there's a certain romantic conception that poverty is dignified, or that it means you're more honest if you're poor. No, it doesn't, actually. In fact, a lot of poor people are shit and a lot of rich people are good.
Yeah. I mean, it's like people who have that mentality have never been both like rich and poor. You know, it's like I've been in like both worlds, and I sort of know, like, I don't know, like I am a better person when I'm rich. Like I am very generous and stuff, whereas when I'm poor, I'm very like scrappy and very like, I don't know, like I like very pragmatic about things. It's and you know, we want to be magnanimous, but I guess like to my point, I had an interview with a guy, Gordon, a call from Aktung Amerikaner. I don't know if are you familiar with them?
No.
They're like a German American thing. So they read my article. I wrote an article that went like kind of semi-viral about like, you know, moving to Nebraska, thinking it was going to be like a white ethno state and not liking it or whatever. So they were sort of like panning that. And they were sort of like, taking it against my sort of like very sort of, I guess, entrepreneurial sort of like mercurial sort of like mindset. Right. And I was sort of talking, to Gordon from the, from that group. And I was saying to him, like, look, if you were to get all the leaders in your group, all the guys with like a 120 IQ, have them all job stacking, making like 500 grand a year as data analysts or software engineers, you can then pay for all of your like members, all of your rank and file members to occupy a home in an inner city neighborhood. You can gentrify it. You can sell it all to like gays or Mexicans or whatever in 5 years and then move to another neighborhood. You can all like collect a pretty penny on it. This could be a huge like scalable operation. And this is something that like Orthodox Jews and stuff already do. Like I'm not like just making something up. This is something that this is literally something that people do, right? It's like you can just like copy it. But it's just like white people don't think about doing stuff like this. It's like, you know, like why? So that's what I'm trying to change.
Yeah. Somebody said, and this, I think you'd probably have an interesting response to this. The issue is that in the right wing, patronage came from kings and aristocracy originally. We don't have that patroning right wing causes now. The billionaires aren't interested, and the nouveau riche types don't play either. Don't contribute either.
That's true. Yeah, that's why we're going to create a new nouveau riche. That's why we're going to. I mean, really, the upper middle class is like the worst social class. But I think they're kind of like the most sort of like bug man in their values, right? But you know, like my plan is to take like normal sort of middle class guys and you know, working class guys and create a new upper middle class of them. And then the upper middle class guys who join currently, they can sort of start job stacking and get into the more overt upper class, and they can kind of become the gentry, and you know, they can start tossing around really big amounts of money. I mean, like we can that's something I'm going to start doing next year, is a fundraising network, right? Like, so I have a friend, for instance, like she's trying to do a movie. She has a movie script. It's like a sort of like right wing art sort of thing, right? And you know, she needs like $400,000. Like it's hard for her to raise that in Hollywood, obviously. You know, like the traditional patronage system, it's kind of difficult to do that if you're on the right, unless you like know somebody or you mediate it or you're somebody like Clint Eastwood or something. But if you're just like a normal person, it's sort of hard to fund right-wing art unless you're already somebody like Dasha or somebody like that, or like Delicious Tacos, right? So like what I want to do is create a network of like really like investors and entrepreneurs who are that like mid-size level, because that's what we're missing, is the mid-size level. And the left already, as the person pointed out, they already sort of like naturally have that. The thing is, it's like, I think that traditionally it was more sort of coded as left-wing because navigating corporate status hierarchies kind of requires that temperament, that kind of you know, personality archetype, like the sort of more, I guess, like leftist, like company man, right? Whereas I think that the more entrepreneurial character of the right, you know, like that does lend itself to job stacking. It does lend itself to what I'm talking about. And, you know, like I think that archetype could take over. And I think that they're going, like with the gig economy and with AI and with the more asymmetrical sort of very Pareto distributed nature of modern work, I mean, it's basically inevitable. Like that person is going to take over, and you know, instead of like everyone making 150 grand a year in these like bugman jobs, you're going to have like a few guys making like 600 or 800, and then most people are just going to be out of work, and they're going to get a UBI or something, which is probably better. I mean, I don't know, but I mean, like it's going to be very asymmetrical, and it's going to take us probably a few decades to like adjust that in an equitable way. And in that wiggle room, you know, it's going to kind of suck for people who don't get their arms around it, who don't kind of figure out how to like make the system work for them. So what I'm trying to do is figure out what's going to happen like 10 years ahead of time. Cause like job stacking isn't going to last forever, right? Like this is just a way to sort of like get all of our guys to have their own personal consultancy, so that like long-term we can pivot into that into like leveraging the very asymmetrical nature of work. And this isn't like my conspiracy theory. Like the CEO of LinkedIn has like said this. The work is going to go in that direction. It's going to be very asymmetric. It's going to be, you know, a lot of AI is going to eliminate a lot of these jobs. It's going to be everyone having their own, like their own consultancy, their own, you know what I mean? Like the people who are agentic and seize life by the balls are the ones who are going to survive in this ecology. And, you know, we have to make sure that those are our guys and not on the left.
Yeah. Yeah. There are some people in the live chat. I think this kind of talk is so novel that some people are reacting to it in a certain slightly negative way, but I think it shouldn't be so novel. That's the whole problem. The whole point is that this is unusual, that we talk about actually succeeding and doing things. That cannot be right. I mean, we can't expect anything good if we have that mindset. There was somebody who said, I think he's Swedish, he said that it's a bit uncouth to talk about getting rich. And he says maybe it's an American-European difference. I think it is. I think Americans, I was going to say Anglo, but even in Britain it is seen as a bit uncouth. But the thing is, we're not talking about this kind of thing like in normal everyday life. This is a specific stream, a specific topic we're talking to each other and hopefully to you, because this stuff needs to be said. I'm sure Walt would agree. This stuff needs to be said. So unfortunately, we have to talk about something that, yeah, in the normal social context would be seen as uncouth, to talk about getting rich and so forth. Yes, I agree. But this isn't the normal social context. And as I say, if we don't talk about this, see, there's always a reason not to do anything. There's always a reason, oh, that wouldn't work, or that wouldn't work as well as we would want it to work, or that might only work for a certain amount of time, or whatever. You can all, believe me, I know from experience what depression is like, what pessimism is like. There's always a reason to do nothing. But our enemies don't have that mindset. Like one person said that, you know, money doesn't really help because it's about whatever group controls the power.
So you should control the power. Like that's what we're doing. We're figuring out how to control the power. It's not.
Yeah. But the point is that there's always a reason not to do anything. But the alternative to doing what Walt says is that people just remain poor and depressed and listless and directionless and, either working a shit job or working no job and lamenting that you don't have a girlfriend and a family. Why? I mean, if you can take part in this, I think you should. I think you should better your situation, better yourselves. Walt, do you have anything to say about that?
Yeah, I have a few things. So number one, when it comes to like power, so there's a lot of different kinds of power, and power is it's circumstantial, right? It's who has the power you look like the Vietnam War, right? I mean, it's like guerrilla warfare in the right sort of circumstances, like asymmetric tactics are more powerful than the established, you know, like the air power, than the power of the state, than the power of, you know, some sort of like hard force. And like these days, power is all about information, right? It's that was why Alex Jones called it InfoWars. It's all about information asymmetries and, stealing IP. I guess the way I see it is, we're not going against the state in any way. We're not doing anything illegal. But the groups that have power in the private realm, whether it's Jews or Indians or like whatever, I mean, it's because they're doing what we're doing. I mean, it's literally, I mean, it's like they just like do it, right? It's like we're just kind of replicating that. And in fact, like we have Jews and Indians like in the group who are like telling us like, I mean, like that we can like leverage experience that they have like from their own communities, right? I mean, this is like very like well documented. I mean, like this is something the sort of stuff that they get away with. I mean, there are Indian guys who like you have seven guys like in a house who are like working on like one job together or something. And like they're all just kind of like shifting between the computer, right? Or you have like guys in India itself who are getting paid like an American salary, right? And they're like double dipping over there, so like they're probably making like the equivalent of like several million dollars just because they're willing to like scam these companies. And like it doesn't take that much. Like you just have to be willing to seize life by the balls and take some calculated risks, right? And like we're figuring out ways that we can get away with that, right? And like we're figuring out like where the limits are. And like what resources are available to people. And I'll tell you this, if I sound like a grifter or whatever, like I have a full money back guarantee. So it's like not, you know, there's literally like no risk of joining. I'll walk you through all the resources we have. I'll walk you through everything we have. So, you know, if a bunch of people join, I might need to do some sort of scalability thing. But the point is, I'm not trying to scam anybody. I'm trying to get guys rich. And I'm trying to do that because it'll get me rich if I get you rich. Right. So it's like the incentives are aligned. Now, when it comes to the whole question, is it kind of gauche, is it kind of uncouth to talk about getting rich? Like, yeah, it is. And that's why America is much richer than Europe, right? It's because we do have that attitude of like, we're going to talk about it. Now, I value Europe being the way it is. I don't want Europe to have the very gauche American attitude towards money. I think it's good that you guys can be the Greece to our Rome. And I want that to continue. But I think that it's important that we have a cross-pollination. So guys in Europe who are interested in, you know, making good money and putting their, you know, energies in their career, they can either come to America or they could, work remotely for an American firm, get an American salary. And I could help you with that because I'm going to be doing wage arbitrage. That's actually a big thing. A guy in like Poland or Romania or even the UK, frankly, can get an American salary and the American company can pay him less than they would any American and he'll still be making a lot more money. And then, the middleman who right now, like I knew a guy who did this. It was a Jewish guy who I worked with at Deloitte. He made a ton of money on that. Like he was making millions. Well, why shouldn't that be me? Right?
Yeah.
Why shouldn't I be helping these guys?
Yeah. Someone has said having an IQ over 120 doesn't mean you can make 200K a year. Plenty of white men with these IQs are denied work. Chris Langan would be a case in point. Now, I would just say about this, I agree, but it's also about social noose. It's not just about having the raw IQ. It's about knowing how to negotiate, how to promote yourself, and so on. So I agree, it's a shame about Chris Langan, and I've got nothing against him. I think, yeah, whatever. But it sounds to me, because I remember reading an article once where somebody, I've no idea where this was, but somebody compared him with a Jewish student, I think at Harvard, who had tried to kill his professor.
Jesus.
And the Jewish student's parents had written to various people and basically got him off. Whereas Chris Langan, he'd never been involved in anything like that. But there was something, I wish I could remember the details, but it was something like he hadn't come from such a... His parents didn't know how to write a letter in his defense or to help him promote himself and so on. And so this essay was making the point that it's not just about having the IQ. It's because that Jewish student, that could have been his life completely ruined at that, and deservedly.
It's knowing how to work the system. It's knowing how to blackmail HR.
Yeah, that kind of thing. So that the point I'm making is quite obvious. Now, someone else said, Chris Langan is so intelligent that he realizes the futility of the rat race. I get what you're saying. But again, the end result of that is that we remain penniless.
Yeah, I mean, the futility of, I got to disagree with that. I think that after a certain point, IQ can actually be sort of maladaptive in the sense that it can, you start to like, I don't want to say overanalyze, but you start to like try to develop extremely precise heuristics for things that are sort of like, they can actually be a liability because oftentimes, oftentimes very smart people will want to get a very precise answer and they'll sort of like derive it from first principles when there's just like an established solution. They can just look at the manual. They can just cheat off somebody else's work. They can just do crib. I mean, that's why China is able to like, catch up to all these other countries, just the copying shit, right? It's like iteration. There was even a book, The Secret of Our Success. Like iteration and like midwit improved, like just kind of experimentation, like very small changes and just kind of copying other people's stuff. That works a lot better than like big brain, like novel, like ingenuity most of the time. Like most of the time that's sort of like, there's the famous example of the Maniac route, right? Where it's like, the big brain person might figure out that, you can remove the bad taste of the maniac root by you don't have to like do the boiling but then like you still have the iodine poisoning, but you won't be able to like sort of figure that out because it's more sort of like higher order consequence of something. So I guess my point is IQ isn't always like there's a reason the average IQ is 100 and not like 160, right? I mean it's like sort of there's I'm not saying it's like always optimal to have like the median result, but there's like a reason we didn't just like evolve towards like omniscience, right? Like there's at a certain point there's a cost, and you tend to get autism, you tend to get I see it in my own cognition. I think my IQ is tested around like somewhere in the 140s, and a lot of times I overanalyze shit, and I'm not like I think it's probably it sounds so like shit eating to say, but I do think my IQ is suboptimally high. I think the most successful people are like 125 IQ, because it's like at a certain point it's like it's kind of a waste of you're just kind of spinning your wheels. At any rate, I guess what I would say is with Chris Langan or whatever, really what it's about is knowing how to blackmail HR. Like, and we have resources for how to do that. Like you can even look at the interview. I see somebody posted in the comments, the interview with the count. So this guy in this interview goes into the details of what you can do to like legally twist their arm. And there's a lot of these HR ladies are like 107 IQ. Like they're like, once you know how to negotiate with them and once you know how to like actually scare them, like a good thing you can do is get a disability registered right away. So they have to do a reasonable accommodation. I don't know what the laws are in Europe. I would assume it's actually more onerous, but I mean, I always say that I'm like autistic and I have ADHD and sometimes I'll speak in a lisp. So they think I'm gay. I mean, like there's things you can do to just make it. Like you just gotta like, You got to use whatever you can, right? Oh, another thing is I put my middle name as like a Hispanic name on my resume before. And there's no reason you can't do that, right?
Like Walt Jorge Bismarck?
Exactly, yeah. There's no, they're right. Not going to check that. And that's completely, and then you'll go through their, yeah. You'll pass the, because the affirmative action, like it's a very, like gaming that is very tricky. But yeah, no, like white guys can do Hispanics and then Indians can do, they can pretend to be black. And that's what a lot of people, like even Mindy Kaling's brother did that, right? It's like people are doing this and it's like, you know, there's no reason not to.
Yeah. Somebody has filled in on it was Oppenheimer. You're right. I probably read it recently in relation to that film. It might well have been an essay written in the wake of that film. So that would make sense. It was Oppenheimer. When he was a student, he poisoned his professor's apple. He injected cyanide into his professor's apple. So anyway, the point is that could have been the end of his career, which would obviously have been dreadful. But his parents, his upper middle class parents, were able to get him off. And so he was able to, you know, design the nuclear bomb and so on. Whereas contrasting that with someone from a less moneyed background or less socially aware sort of parentage, they don't have the ability to do that. So it's just an interesting contrast. And again, I'm not saying anything. I have no idea what Christopher Langan's background was like, but this I'm just quoting an essay that I read about a year ago. Okay, now there was another one that I wanted to pick.
Sorry, can I just interject real quick?
Yeah.
What I wanted to say was, I mean, how do you think Jews got rich? It's like they were working class to begin with, and they you know they would have been the WASPs thought the Jews had terrible manners, but Jews are like the Talmudic reasoning, right? They're good at following rules, so they learn how to make the rules work for them. And as long as you can like weaponize the rules against your enemy, then you'll get rich, and then your kids will have all of the same social skills that the WASPs have, plus the mastery of the rules, right? So. Yeah, I mean, that's my attitude. Like, I'm very autistic. I mean, you can see how fast I'm talking. You can see how kind of, like, uncomfortable I'm probably making a lot of it. I mean, it's like, I'm still rich because I know how to weaponize rules. I think like a Jew. So it's like, that's, you know, like, I make people uncomfortable. And I'm like, gauche and weird. But, like, it doesn't, you know, like being socially adroit is great. But, I mean, I don't know. Like, really, it's about being able to, like, blackmail your enemy. That, you know.
Strong arm them, let's see.
Yeah.
Some of the comments just gone off the top, so I can't read it now, but it was someone saying winning by deception or that kind of thing will eventually backfire against you. You and your crew will eventually be blackballed and blacklisted. What would you say to that?
I can go into like all the things that we're doing. So it's like, for instance, we're we have like some pretty robust OPSEC measures, but like really, like we're like nothing we're doing is illegal. Number one, like and we're not like we're making everybody anything that we're doing like collaboration between people. We're having people sign NDAs. We're consulting with lawyers like at every step of the way. Like we have multiple lawyers in the group. We have like a council of like five guys, including several Jews. You know, so it's like I figure that they know what they're talking about. I have friends who are lawyers. I myself have been. I don't know, like I worked at Deloitte and I even have a story about this on my Substack about how I went into like this protracted, you know, legal battle with this Jewish guy for like over a few days I've been in situations where, you know, like high stakes sort of like legal situations. Like I know how to like navigate these things. Right. And I know how to like set up an infrastructure that's not going to be, you know, exposed in that way. And what I will say too, is that I don't mind if I'm going to get doxxed at some point. Right. Like I mean, once that happens, like I'll like get more rich. Like I'll figure out a way to like monetize it, right? So like I'm not really worried about that. But I definitely don't want my guys to get doxxed. But we're taking a lot of precautions to prevent that. And like for instance, like our staffing firm and our dummy the dummy firm we're using for experience fabrication, like nobody knows what it is, and like you only get access to it, you know, once you sign the NDA. So you know, anybody who you know squeals, like we could sue them for quite a bit of money, and then. Even if that happens, like we can easily create a new one, right? Like out of thin air, really. So, I mean, I think our model is pretty. Like,
yeah. He's just said you have a website that says exactly what your strategy is. Do you think no one is going to find that?
No, of course they will. But it doesn't matter. See, that's the thing is like, I'm not trying to do like a secret like society here. I mean, it's like, I did that a bit at first to sort of like, you know, for the aesthetics or whatever, but like, no, I am operating out in the open. And I mean, people are welcome to try. I'm sure there's going to be some SPLC Jews who are like watching this right now and like wanting to like infiltrate, or, you know, there's going to be like some people who are going to want to try to like come after us. But I'm confident in the infrastructure we have, like, is robust, and there isn't anything that can be exploited. So, I mean, and again, if I were to personally get doxed myself, I'd be fine with that. But like, I know for a fact that our guys are well insulated. And, you know, like, we've made sure that any sort of like shilling each other into, so there are certain things, right? Like shilling each other into firms, you know, like that could have an OPSEC risk, but like, we make sure that, everybody is like sort of individually accountable for that. And it's not something that, you know, like it's something that like members would negotiate between themselves for now until we build out a scalable infrastructure to ensure the OPSEC for that. But like, I mean, I don't know, like, I'm not going to be a chump about this. I'm not going to like design, you know, like a shitty thing that could get like easily exposed, right? Because I mean, like, I intend to use this to become very wealthy, right? So like, I'm not gonna, you know, like fuck it up and like have the entire thing get like get sabotaged at the beginning.
Yeah, someone's just said Walt Bismarck has got to have Italian ancestry. His verbal rate of fire is like a machine gun.
Oh yeah, I'm on 2 Adderall right now because I've been up for like 46 hours, I think. So yeah, I mean, I don't sleep very much, so I tend to take quite a bit of amphetamines to, you know, especially in moments like this.
Right. Okay. I think some people are alarmed by what you just said about the legal team, in your crew. What would you say about that? That, you know, you should never trust certain people, that kind of thing.
I mean, I don't trust anybody. I trust financial incentives, and they're incentivized to like align with us. The thing is, it's like, look, back in the day, the alt-right was very heavily Mischling. And like, I would even say that like a lot of my friends in the movement, women I've dated through, I mean, like it's, there have always been Jews in like pro-white spaces. And I think that, I guess my feelings on the JQ are kind of complicated. I could, I would call myself kind of a philo anti-Semite, I suppose. I think there are people of high highs and low lows, and I, you know, all of my best experiences in life have been with Jews, and all of my worst have been with Jews. So, you know, I know how to, I don't know. Like, I know that like there's a certain, you can't act like it's like exactly the in-group, right? But I mean, with individuals, I think you can extend, you know, that bond of friendship. And I trust everybody who is in the group as an individual, and you know, they've acquitted themselves well. And again, like, I don't even really need the trust because, again, the incentive structure is aligned, and they really wouldn't have any reason to defect, especially because the political ecology these days is completely different from it was a decade ago. And I think this is something a lot of people in the DR are sort of like blind to, especially after October 7th. I mean, like, really, a lot of Jews, a lot of like more right-wing Jews kind of see themselves as white now. And like, there's a sort of assimilation impulse, especially with like Zoomer Jews, especially in like Florida. Like, right wing Jews in Florida are just like Italian, right? I mean, like, it's not now I recognize the whole like dual loyalty thing was like a thing. I think that I think people are over indexing on their experience being part of like the Ron Paul libertarian thing, and there definitely was a cadre of like Jewish intellectuals, like the neocons, who were sort of like you know, going after Ron Paul very aggressively, calling him an anti-Semite in a very sort of hysterical way. That was completely unjustified. But what I would say, though, is that a lot of those, the boomer Jews are sort of like not relevant anymore. Like, the people who had like Holocaust grandmas or whatever, who like were very hysterical and paranoid about any sort of white identity, like, Zoomer Jews tend to see themselves as white. Or if they're like left wing, they like, I don't know, it's not like the same thing it was 10 years ago in my mind. So I think that the JQ is like, it's something we should be aware of. It's not like something that's like gone away, but I think it's something that is much less of a concern. I mean, even if you look at someone like Ben Shapiro these days, like, he's not like anti-white like he used to be, right? Because he recognizes that he needs, like Israel needs white America, or else it's like fucked, right? And like, the power balance is actually different from what it used to be. They need the Christian nationalists, and there's less of a sort of like slavish devotion to Zionism in that element these days than there used to be. So because of that, they have to tolerate a lot more overt pro-white sentiment, and they can't get away with policing it as much. And maybe you think, okay, well, they'd still rather not be there. I mean, maybe, but I think Ben Shapiro like genuinely doesn't like worry about a Holocaust in America. I think he saw that Trump did whatever Kushner wanted him to do, and he doesn't really care. So I mean, I think that like viewing like the sort of like, I don't know. I mean, I've never been the sort of person who viewed like viewed it as like a sort of like spiritual war against the Jew or whatever. I mean, I think that there's incentive structures, and I think different groups can be aligned against each other in different ways. But I think that things are always shifting on the ground. And coalitionally speaking, American politics are such that Jews are shifting towards the right, and they're shifting towards the white in a sense. They're becoming assimilated into greater American like whiteness. And I don't think in 20 years Zoomer Jews will be noticeably different from Italians. That's kind of my theory.
I've heard other people saying this, that in America, Jews are going to just, be absorbed into the white mainstream in a couple of generations, like by the end of this century. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, I would obviously caution you against being relaxed on this matter, because you never know. You've got to be careful.
Oh, no, I've been double-crossed. Like, look, I mean, I've dated a lot of Jewish girls. My best friend who sort of like stabbed me in the back. I mean, like I've been in a lot of situations that like, I'm wise, but like I myself am, I don't want to say a predator, but I'm like savvy. I don't know. I've been in, I don't know, like consulting for a long time. I've like dealt with a lot of like dangerous sort of people. Like I'm not worried about somebody double crossing me. Like I can sort of like suss that out. Right. So, I mean, I think it's sort of like the onus is on you to create something that's robust enough that you can't be double crossed and that you can't be, sort of exposed in that way. And it's sort of like, I know how to do business with Jews. Like, it's fine.
All right. Well, I hope so. All right. There were a few super chats. So I'll get to those now. Hold on a second. There is one person who, okay. Okay, Alt-White said, let's help get right-wing white guys rich. Yes, definitely. Stephen said, everyone should download the app Yandex to their phone or computer. It's totally non-censorship. It's like the internet before 2016. Ironically run by Russia, who we are told is anti-free speech. Type black and white violence into Google, you get results about black civil rights. Use Yandex and you get fact. All right, thank you for that tip. Green Party. Is Walt worried that Substack could kill the race realist or dissident right webzine scene? Instead of writing articles for American Renaissance or Countercurrents, young writers may all have their own Substacks. Is that a plus?
Yeah, I think so. It is because at the end of the day, I think that for a long time. There is a sense in which like everybody's trying to monetize and everybody's trying to build their own platform, but like not everyone's talented enough to do that. And not everyone, you know, can really make it. And like maybe some people would do better if they were just sort of like herded into a more sort of conventional publication. But I think that the trade-off is that people who are talented, you know, can monetize at a much younger age and with much less experience. And it's a much more sort of like entrepreneurial sort of ecology where, you know, people who have the merit can just like build something, right? And I'm always in favor of that. Like I'm going to be against any sort of like system that, you know, just forces everybody to kind of go through the established channels. Cause I mean, like if anything, my whole impulse, like starting Tortuga, like part of it was like motivated against like credentialing regimes and against like seniority systems. It's like, you know, I want like young guys who are talented and capable to go be like a millionaire by like fighting aggressively and like, you know, going out to establish their own thing. So yeah, I mean, and obviously I'm benefiting from Substack. So, you know, but then there are people who won't. So like, it's just important to know that there's always going to be a trade-off.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, they could go down that road. Substack could get strong-armed into going censorious, but so far that doesn't seem to be happening. The feeling I have personally is that I said this last millennial and I stick by it now. I think that we have passed the peak of online censorship, at least for now. I mean, there'll be maybe another phase of it 10 years from now or whatever, but I don't think it's continuous now from 2018. I think 2018 to 2020, 21 was the peak. And, yeah, I think it's a better climate now. It's more open than it was then. Okay, Hal 9000 said to me, he said, you'd get away with a paywall now for millennial. The brand is firmly established and paid subs are key to making a living online. That's what worked for a school friend of mine who's now a high net worth individual. Yeah, I probably would be able to paywall millennial, but I don't want to do that because it's something for everyone. It's something for the whole community. And even though it might work financially I don't think it would be the right thing to do. I just don't think I couldn't do that with a clear conscience, because I know, I mean, the original mission statement, no reactionary will be alone this Christmas, that remains. And so that includes the ones who don't have much money. So I would never pay Wall Millennial.
It's also just better for your brand to have it free. I mean, like, you get more eyeballs, you get more exposure, which, like, for the rest of the year, you can monetize content, and, you know, it's just kind of, like, good for your overall power and the, you know.
Exactly. I mean, exactly. I think it works if you give some stuff away for free. When I started on Substack, that was something I read. I think they had some sort of quick start guide or something, and it said you should actually make your best work free, because that's the stuff that establishes your reputation. You want people to see your best work. So it's interesting. I might paywall more of my Substack essays in future. I don't know. I want to make more money for reasons. And I don't want a jewel plated jacuzzi. As I said earlier, I just want more freedom and options. So like anyone does. So I might do that in future, but I would never paywall Millennial. Okay, Alt-White said, every ethnic group, including Jews, work for the best interests of their own tribe, their own ethnic group. We should be doing the same. I completely agree. And it sounds like Walt has an infrastructure for doing that. Walt, would you like to say anything about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, it's something that it's not... I think that, like, most of the time it happens kind of behind the scenes right now in America. And I think that, like, it's sort of hard to call out, because you have sort of institutions that are sort of, like, very abstracted, or, you know, it happens at dinner parties, it happens at churches, it happens at synagogues, it happens at, like, birthday parties and luncheons. So, like, a lot of times the people aren't, like, meeting in a room, because there was some antecedent moment where people met in a room, and, like, so it's no longer necessary, because there's sort of just a cultural infrastructure where people know each other and people can sort of, like, shill each other in, and it's just sort of understood, right? So it's, like, it's sort of hard to map onto what we're doing, because we're sort of having to create everything from whole cloth. But, like, long term, we're going to have the same sort of networks that are much more implicit and that feel a lot more, you know, gauche and honorable to people or whatever. Like, I think that the thing is, like, you sort of have to start off with a very sort of concrete a very sort of like formalist kind of structure, and then it can become more mediated and more abstracted, which feels more honorable, you know, over time, as it becomes more of like a, I mean, that's probably how the Freemasons were, right? You have sort of like clandestine, you know, like symbols or, you know, shibboleths or whatever, to sort of like communicate with people. And then that's something I would love to work towards. But I would say that right now, like, we absolutely have to, because especially with Indians, I mean, it's a very high IQ group, Brahmins, who are coming in large numbers, and they're very, you know, very committed to a certain strategy. And we have to be willing to deploy the exact same strategy. And it's not about hating anybody. It's not about, you know, it's just about not being a sucker, right? You gotta fight fire with fire.
Yeah, I completely agree. Okay, Stephen said, Substack is a great opportunity for reaching intellectuals and outlining our views, both for posterity and as a collection of sort of manifestos. But we must be honest with ourselves. It's not a substitute for X and YouTube. We can't lie to ourselves about Substack replacing regular normie outreach. That's true, but I don't think that what Walt is talking about is normie outreach. Would that be correct, Walt?
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm not really interested in normies. I think really I'm interested in, like, the top 10%. Like, I'm interested in, I mean, anyone watching this is going to be in that category, by the way, right? I mean, like, anybody who consumes ideas, anybody who, like, listens to a long form interview or reads, you know, a long form essay is going to be in that category. But, like, I'm not interested in somebody who's just, you know, some, like, 97 IQ, you know, person who's just going to, like, look at a tweet or look at, like, a TikTok or whatever. It's like those people, like, they're kind of like furniture. And, like, I don't mean that in, like, a mean way. It's just sort of like, you know, like they're going to just kind of do what they're told, or like not even that, like they're just not going to do anything. It's really like in any sort of society, it's really like a very small, it's like the Pareto principle. It's a very small segment of the population that's doing anything. And, you know, with any movement, right, like you always get a certain core cadre of guys who are doing like all the hard work. If you look at the alt-right, right, I mean, there's probably really only like 300, 500 of us. And then like you had a bunch of like hangers on who, you know, I mean, like we appreciated their support and everything. And, you know, like sometimes that would be financial support or sometimes like emotional, whatever. But at the end of the day, like the people who are movers and shakers who can sort of like influence things in the world, those are the people who I'm interested in getting. And, you know, I'm interested in like finding like business partners and people who can sort of like be leaders in their communities. And because everybody has their own dependents. Everybody has their own like network of people who are like lower IQ or lower agency who they can sort of like establish a fiefdom over and have like a patronage over. And, you know, like you can establish influence like, you know, like through other people's networks, right? Once you provide like the sort of central infrastructure, it lets you be kingmaker. So that's sort of the role I'm interested in playing, is sort of like connecting with people who are capable, who are leaders, who are creators. And then in doing so, like that gets you tremendous power, like instrumentally, because everybody has, you know, their own kind of like leadership position. And I'm interested in cultivating that sort of like, that sort of structure. Everybody has their own patronage network. And that's how we engage with normies. But it's like, you engage with normies by being their friend or their lover or their spouse or, you know, whatever, you know, and like a coworker. But it's like, you know, just having content that's trying to like reach normies. I mean, I don't know, like normies will get swayed one direction or another for completely stupid reasons. I mean, it's not, you know, they don't care about arguments, right? They're not going to like read, you know, they're not going to like try to like assess like the merits of your, you know, like it's all purely like it's all purely like emotional manipulation. And really just having that personal connection with somebody is by far the most effective. So really, I'm repeating myself, but yeah, I mean, I'm focused on that, the cadre of elites.
Okay. All right. There was one from, oh yeah, Stephen also said, you made my ears perk up. Lol. My bachelor's is, I think this is when you were talking about the, it was about an hour ago. And he said, my bachelor's is in applied mathematics. I've done bits of data analysis at work in the past, been prepping for the actuary exams. And I want to transition fully to data analysis or actuary science. I would totally contribute to your society if it could help place me. Well, there we go. I can put you in touch. He also said, as an American, I'm totally down with based whites getting rich. I get why working class Brits might find it distasteful, but helping our guys get wealthy isn't the same thing as some asshole blowing 50K on a number plate so that you can see he's better than you. Yeah, exactly. I mean, it doesn't have to be vulgar. It's simply about resources and having them instead of wallowing in the fact that we don't have them. Okay, Black Pigeon Pilled said, how does Walt propose turning our people into wizards and remain focused on the core principles which defined us in 2016?
Wizards? When I think of the core principles that defined us in 2016, I mean, yeah, I think it was really just a small group of guys who were, if we're talking about wizards, if we mean like, you know, being very sort of like metapolitically adroit and able to sort of like navigate the body politic in this like hyper agentic way, like we were able to back then. I honestly think it was, I think the alt-right was a really special moment in history. And I tried to kind of create something like that on Substack with the alt-right. I tried to sort of like, you know, and I got an interesting community of people, but it's like really the alt-right was like lightning in a bottle, right? It was like, you had all these different forces. You had like sort of like the detritus of like new atheism and libertarianism kind of going in with like the manosphere and Gamergate, and like it was all sort of like swirling, you know, together, and it became like this incredibly vital force. And I mean, it was really like a once in a lifetime sort of thing. And the thing is, like, movements like that come and go, and you can't I don't think you can like really over index on any like particular moment in time. And I certainly have a tendency to do that. I mean, I still, you know, I joke, it's like the alt-right was like my Woodstock. I act like it's still 2016 all the time. But I guess like for me, like when it comes to capturing that energy and when it comes to capturing the good things about that, like what are the sort of the commonalities? I would say that number one, it was like thinking very, like thinking about metapolitics, like as the like sort of default framing. Right. And like not caring as much about object level politics, because object level politics to me, it doesn't really matter that much. I mean, it's sort of like, you know, like your policy on like tariffs or like, you know, like what the interest rate should be. I mean, like it's kind of like vary with technology and culture and macroeconomic conditions and geopolitical conditions. It's like, I feel like wasting breath on that is just like such. I mean, it seems very tedious to me. Like to me, to the extent we talk about politics, it should be about metapolitics. It should be about defining the terms of our alliances and sort of like thinking very proactively about that, so we can sort of like manipulate the body politic like ahead of time. And I think the alt-right was really good about doing that back then. And I think the DR, I mean, there's certainly people like Dave Green, like he's really good at that. And, you know, like I've tried to do that to the extent that I've engaged with people here, but like, I feel like maybe more the like lower brow aspects of the DR have completely neglected that. And they don't seem very interested in that at all. I don't know. I feel like that's been to the detriment.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think that's all the super chats, unless there are any others that come in pretty quickly. What would you like to say to people who have reservations, you know, about working with other ethnic groups, as in your organization?
Yeah. What I'll say is that like the average like Jewish person who like you're sort of like thinking here's one thing I'll say is that I've worked with finance bro Jews, like actual elite Jews, and they're like not the sort of Jews who were writing like, you know, 10 Reasons Why People Suck by Israel Shekelstein and BuzzFeed, right? Like those were like Jewish fail sons. Those were kind of like the losers who couldn't become like even a dentist, let alone, you know, like working at like New York Times or something like that. I mean, like they weren't really. I think that a lot of people sort of over-index based on that and based on the neocons in the Ron Paul era. And I think that, again, there's reasons to have, you know, like we're different people. We're going to have different interests at different times. And we shouldn't think that it's going to be a very seamless transition. There's going to be times when, you know, there is going to be hostility. But I mean, even if you look at within America's like racial coalitional politics over the past century, like Jews were a very reliable ally for like Italians and Irish and other sort of like white ethnics, you know, against like the sort of WASP majority. And, you know, like I think that they just have their interests like we have our interests, and they, you know, they are probably more, they're higher verbal IQ. They're more sort of like brutal. They're more willing to like sort of act very like ruthlessly against their enemies, which honestly, I think we need to emulate. Like the thing is, I guess my kind of tendency when I look at a group who, you know, is winning against us, like I want to steal their tactics. I think of like Rome, right, as my aspirational ideal. I think of how like Rome stole like Carthaginian naval technology or Gallic metallurgy or, you know, Greek philosophy. I mean, like Rome was a multicultural society, but it was also like a supremacist society, right? And that's sort of like my impulse. I am a multiculturalist. I have that's sort of why I moved against, I mean, I even wrote an essay why I'm no longer a white nationalist. I call myself a white globalist. I've sort of moved in a similar direction, I guess, as Richard Spencer in the sense that I do think of like the white boy is being like outwardly focused. Like we're not like Tokugawa Japan, where, you know, conquistadors, we're explorers, we're traders, we're, you know, merchants. We're like, we're meant to interact with other races and we don't necessarily need to like mix with them. But to the extent that we can do business and we can do, you know, productive interchange, I think that's useful. I'd also say that there are a lot of Jews who they might be downwardly mobile, or they might be, you know, like again, Florida Jews, as opposed to like New York or California Jews, who are basically, you know, it's a very different sort of ecology that they're sort of like much more like Italian in their sensibilities. Right. You know, and like one of my best friends, Rajiv, he's a second generation Indian, and he's, I mean, I don't know, he's basically white in his sensibilities. Right. And he's like very pro white, and he's pro Western. He supports the sort of like he supports like he doesn't want like H-1Bs to come over and, you know, have seven guys working in like one house and like one job to like take away jobs from like white Americans. Like he's against that. He sides with us as opposed to that. And it's sort of like he can, you know, like kind of give us insights into like, that's another thing, right? Is that like if you look at like the history of the white race, like we've always been outward looking, we've always made alliances with other groups. And we've always sort of, you know, like that's how we've sort of like expanded our glory and greatness, is like, we haven't been isolationists. We haven't been Tokugawa Japan. We've been making allies with certain tribes, like in other, you know, ethnic groups. And, you know, we were willing to play that game. And that's what kind of separated us back in the Roman times and the colonial times. I mean, we've always had that impulse. So I just reject the scarcity mindset of like, no, we can't work with Indians or Jews. We can't work with, you know, people of other. I mean, like to me, that's like cowardice. Like, I mean, like the thing is, you have to design a robust incentive structure so that, you know, there won't be like a big loophole where like you're sort of like exposed, right? But I mean, I've been in business long enough that I won't do that. And you also just have to be a good, you know, trust of individual character. You have to be good at like cultivating relationships with people. You have to be good at like sort of, you know, you have to have like a certain level of social acumen. But I think that like, you know, if you're willing to do that, then you're going to be like Hernan Cortez. You're going to be like Vasco da Gama, you know, and you won't be like the dumb goy who gets played. And I have been the dumb goy who got played before. But like, you know, it's because I have been that I won't be in the future, like, because I've seen that, right? But it's like, I'm not going to like resent permanently, you know, other groups for just like doing business in an effective way. It's like, you have to learn how to do business that way yourself. And that's how you dominate. And that's how you become like a Roman, as opposed to like a peasant, right? As opposed to like a hobbit. And I don't want our guys to be hobbits. I don't want our guys to be, you know, unagentic and not seizing control over the world. I want our guys to be competing at the highest level with sharks. And that's another thing, is when you're competing with Jews and Brahmin Indians, they're like forcing you to like compete at the highest level. And that's what like Romans would do, right? Like the Romans wouldn't like keep them. I mean, like they would integrate them into their societies, right? Like it was a fairly multicultural society, but it's like they had confidence that they would win because they had confidence that the Romans were superior. And that's, I have confidence that we're going to win. Right. I mean, like, and I have confidence that like people will want to affiliate with us because we have the most glorious civilization, the most glorious history, and we have the best vision for the world. And there's a reason why Hong Kongers want to like live the white people way. There's a reason why Indians come to America and want to like live the white people way. You know, like it is superior. And I want to sort of impose that, you know, like aggressively. And I want to, it's not a hateful impulse. It's an impulse of self-confidence, but also one of pluralism, of bringing people into your thing, you know? So, I mean, I think it's entirely positive.
Yeah. Sorry. I mean, I have a lot of affection for the common people, the hobbits, and so on, that's your term. And I think I've heard Richard Spencer saying similar. I don't have contempt for them, but, I do recognize that they need to be protected, and it needs to be their own people of their own ethnic group who are able to operate at a higher level who protect them. Otherwise, they will get eaten up by the wishes of other ethnic groups. And that is just so obvious at this point. I mean, I just saw Hamza Yousaf on Twitter complaining about the AfD in Germany, and then mere minutes or seconds later, there was this attack on the German Christmas market in Magdeburg. The reality of that, the details of it are yet to emerge, but it just seemed ironic. And people were saying that at the time, that the timing of his tweet couldn't have been better. He's moaning about white ethnocentrism, and then moments later we get crystal clear evidence as to the necessity for white ethnocentrism. So ordinary people, I don't have contempt for them at all. I think they are the lifeblood of our people.
You need those who work, right? Like you can't just have, I mean, like you need a productive capacity, right? Like just doing arbitrage and just doing symbol manipulation. Maybe if we had robots like doing everything, then, you know, but like at a certain, like you just need people to do like work, right? I mean, like, yeah, I totally agree. I guess the thing is, though, it's arbitrage and symbol manipulation that enable their productive energies to be utilized, you know, in a particular direction, right? So, I mean, it's just, I guess that's why I have a particular focus. And I mean, I know my attitude rubs a lot of people the wrong way. And I totally, you know, I get that. I know I have an abrasive kind of narcissistic personality. It's you know, I understand that. But I guess what I'm saying is, like, you need people like that to sort of, like, yeah, protect the hobbits, because otherwise, like, they're not going to be, they're not even gonna be like, it's not, won't even really be on the radar. They're just gonna get like scammed all the time and get sort of like exploited. And you know, like it's important for us to develop that sort of mindset. But what I would say, though, is that you can't develop that mindset in a vacuum. Like you need to interface with the outside world, and you need to, I mean, like look at someone like Alexander the Great. He's the sort of person I'm looking to. Like he wasn't you know, isolating the Macedonians. He was having them go seed a bunch of like Persian women. I mean, he was like taking them all across Asia. He was just conquering everything, right? And then he didn't like kill Porus. He didn't like refuse to associate with Porus. He established him as a satrap, and then they were you know, collaborators from then on out. And that's the way you're supposed to do it. Like you're not supposed to have this like very like rigidly dominious or very exclusionary impulse. Like you should be you should have some sort of level of like cultural chauvinism or supremacism, like just, you know, like no civilization can exist without that. But at the same time, you need to be pluralist and you need to be open to learning things from other people. And Jews and Indians have a lot to teach us. And, you know, frankly, I mean, the fact that we haven't like done this, it kind of speaks to like the fact that they have a lot to teach us. And, you know, like if they're offering collaboration, then I think like smacking away the hand would be kind of silly. And again, you know, take reasonable precautions, trust but verify. But you know, as long as you do that, I think that's going to get you there a lot faster and a lot more reliably.
Okay. All right. Well, I think that's all the super chats. There was one person who said he's complaining about the term the alt-right, but I think that's academic at this point. Okay. Yeah. Padfa says, Walt is commercial-facing in approach. Dissident right is social, meta, and cultural. Different things, and commercial world will not buy that, although strong in-group preference is just common sense. Yeah, I would agree with that. I think, as I said earlier, I want people to be successful, prosperous, happy, and to have agency, and to have the power, the money to support things and to have the lives that they want to have, but more broadly to support the pro-European cause. And I would support that. I do think that people need to be careful about alliances. You know, I'll underline that because I think it would be remiss of me not to say that. Obviously, what works should be used.
Let me emphasize. I'm not asking anybody watching this to ally with Jews or ally with any other ally with anybody you don't want to. I mean, that's like, I'll do that, right? And you can use whatever resources you want to get from me, and you and I can make money off each other however you want. I'm not asking you to trust Jews. I'm asking you to trust me. You know, just trust Uncle Walt here. And you know, maybe I'm a little too Michelin coded in the way I talk or the way I sort of comport myself. But I think if you look at my history, I did a lot for the movement back in the day. In terms of, like propagating the ideas out there. And I think I'm, if you look at my writings, like you'll see that I'm still sort of allied with, I'm not a white nationalist anymore, but like I said, I'm a white globalist, and I am pro-white, I am identitarian. And I do have, we don't have to agree 100% of the time. If we agree 60% of the time, and then we can use each other to advance directionally where appropriate. I think that like politics is coalitional and transactional. Right. Like the idea that you need to be 100% aligned on all things in order to like have a productive alliance is like ludicrous. At the end of the day, I mean, like, you need to be pragmatic and make alliances where you can. And, I know how to do business with Jews, and I feel like I can succeed there. And if you don't want to do that, I'm not going to ask you to, you can leave that to me. And again, you can engage with me and my organization to whatever extent you want. And as I said, I have a complete money back guarantee thing, and I will walk you through everything we have. I'm going to be, I'm the utmost Nebraskan in my my business ethics about it. So feel free to DM me on Substack or wherever if you want to like talk about the organization. I could set up an intake call with you, or you could just the fastest way is to just go to the website and purchase membership. I will say if you want to get in, I would do so now because it's going to double. The price is going to double in 10 days, so it's going to go from 250 to 500. And we're going to be rolling out a lot of stuff over the next few weeks. So it's going to be. It's going to be the increase in value is going to be more than doubling. So, it's definitely a good investment to get in now. But I'm pretty confident that a lot of people in this chat will get in at some point because we're going to be putting a lot of points on the board over the next few months. I'll be putting out testimonials. I'll be putting out, white papers, sort of like explaining cases of people having succeeded, right? And, different analytics on the job market. I mean, like we're going in a good direction. And, if you join the group, you'll have complete transparency into everything we're doing. And, we have a stand-up call twice a week where you can talk directly to me. I run it pretty democratically. If you have any concerns, if you have any collaboration ideas, if you have an idea, you can make money with me. I'm always open for that. So, I think it's a fun group. I think we're doing some cool things. So I'd love to have anybody.
All right. Excellent. Well, I'll be back in about 10 minutes with Harrison's H. Smith. But in the meantime, Walt Bismarck, thank you for appearing on Millennial X.
Thank you for having me. Have a great rest of your evening.
Okay.
Take care. Bye.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial, but how about giving something back to your tireless host? Commemorating 10 years of Millennial, this unique animated vector graphic is available as an NFT for one lucky owner, and only one. The auction closes on the 30th. Make your bid today.